This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Scientists will tell you that science fiction can be the basis for a future science fact, the ability to think outside the box, to think of big ideas. Well, you know, that's been a core of science fiction. And as Arthur C. Clarke, who had a pretty good track record for predicting the future, said on BBC's Horizon program in 1964, you'll only be able to predict the future if you think really big.
Trying to predict the future is a discouraging and hazardous occupation because the prophet invariably falls between two stools. If his predictions sound at all reasonable, you can be quite sure that in 20 or at most 50 years, the progress of science and technology has made him seem ridiculously conservative. So, if what I say now seems to you to be very reasonable, then I'll have failed completely. Only if what I tell you appears absolutely unbelievable have you any chance of visualizing the future as it really will happen.
Arthur C. Clarke back in 1964. Well, a new book called Hieroglyph aims to use the same theme of thinking about the future as a tool to jumpstart our society, which just can't seem to think or act big anymore, into innovative thinking once again. With me as a contributor to this new collection, you could call him the instigator of the Hieroglyph Project. Neal Stephenson is a sci-fi writer and author of books including Snow Crash and the three-volume Baroque Cycle. He joins us now from Seattle. Neal, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. How you doing?
Seems like Arthur C. Clarke had it right.
I sometimes wish I were living in that era when the kind of technologies we were working with had more kind of easily predictable outcomes. You know, if you've got a rocket, you can imagine what it would be like if you had a bigger rocket, and you can write a story about that. But the internet and other technologies we work with now are a lot harder to predict.
But what makes you think that sci-fi stories can be a spur to innovation?
The best way to think about this project, Ira, is as an experiment. It came out of a discussion that I had at a conference with Michael Crow, the president of Arizona State. And what we were talking about was, you know, does science fiction actually have a role to play or doesn't it? And we ended up deciding that the simplest thing to do was just to try to write some stories in that vein and get them out there and see what happened.
Mm-hmm. And so you put this the book together, and did the Hieroglyph stories have to follow certain rules set up?
Rules and writers don't go together very well, so we did lay down some general guidelines. Mm-hmm. I think the most important was no hyperspace, which just means that we didn't think it would serve our purposes to have stories where that were based on outlandish technology that violates the known laws of physics and that nobody in today's world actually has got access to. So we tried to hold it to technologies that modern-day engineers and scientists could get their hands on very soon.
Mm-hmm. What about all these post-apocalyptic science fiction novels that are out now? Were they ruled out also?
We had another rule, which was no holocausts, small h, plural. The idea being that although there's been a lot of interesting work done in a post-apocalyptic vein, particularly in movies and television, that wasn't necessarily going to serve the purposes of this anthology. So we were trying to steer away from the trend towards grubby post-apocalyptic dystopian fiction.
Yeah. Let's give our audience an idea of the kind of stuff that you're talking about. Your contribution is a story about building a tall tower, 20 kilometers tall. That's 6 times 2. So that's 12 miles tall. That's so much taller than the biggest building on Earth now, right? What caught your imagination about this?
Well, this came from a technical paper that had been published about 10 years ago by Jeff Landis, who's both he's kind of a prototype for this in that he's both a physicist and a writer of science fiction and poetry. Acting as a physicist, he had written these papers saying that using steel, so using a very well-known material that we know how to make today, mm-hmm. it should be possible to make towers of that height, and that if we were to do so, then by launching basically conventional rockets from the top of that tower, we would be able to effect a very significant reduction in the cost of launching payloads into low Earth orbit. Mm-hmm. So that was the technical kernel around which this story developed. And then what I did was to turn it into a story that's kind of in a somewhat more of a golden age of science fiction kind of mentality than I'm generally known for writing.
Let me bring in another voice into the conversation, because Neil, you needed some help figuring out how this tall tower could actually work. So let's bring in a structural engineer. Keith Chelmsted is a professor of structural engineering at Arizona State University. Welcome, Keith.
Thank you.
You got a call from Neil asking about his tall tower idea. Did you think he was crazy, or did you think he had a great idea?
Well, these are things that don't happen to you every day, of course. And as a structural engineer, I've been interested in building tall for my whole career. Mm-hmm. But tall usually means just a little bit taller than the last thing. And the tallest building in the world right now is the Burj Khalifa in Dubai. And that's 0.8 kilometers tall. And so thinking about something 20 kilometers tall was definitely mind-blowing in a way, but I'm open to lots of kinds of things like that, and I welcome the challenge.
Is it possible to build a 20-kilometer tower with materials we have now?
Initially, I really wasn't sure about that. So the first thing that I set out to do was just prove to myself whether it was possible or impossible, and I think I eventually convinced myself that it is indeed possible. As an engineer, the next question is it feasible? And that's, you know, a lot of other things besides physics go into that kind of a question.
Mm-hmm. Neil, what does the tower in your story look like?
It would look sort of like a gas of metal. Structurally, what you're trying to do is take the minimum amount of steel you need to make it stand up and kind of distribute it over a very wide space to give it more strength. And so it would be largely kind of transparent as seen from the ground until you got up to sort of the higher altitudes where we ended up envisioning the possibility of using some extra hardware at those altitudes to deal with the problem of getting hit by the jet stream. This tower is tall enough that it would project up through the band of altitude where the jet stream is active, and that becomes by far the most difficult problem that Keith, I think, had to tackle in his work.
Keith, is insurmountable?
Not insurmountable. It's initially we were looking at the thing as the tower, can it carry its own weight? And steel's pretty heavy. And that was really the calculation that Landis had done originally. And it didn't include stability. Mm-hmm. Well, you can't stick a rope up and expect it not to buckle. But the jet stream is a very, very big deal. And virtually all very tall buildings are governed by wind loads. And the winds in the jet stream are probably three or four times what hurricane force winds are here on the surface of the planet. And so they're pretty important,
yeah,
but not insurmountable.
When you got the assignment, did you think possibly about using nanotechnology particles like graphene, super strong things like that are stronger than steel? And might you rethink that idea again?
Well, that's, I think the ground rule really was materials that are available today, and there's a whole other sort of branch of this thinking called space elevators, and
right.
those have been kind of hinged on the existence of a material that would make them possible. And I think what we really wanted to do was not have that conversation that this is great, except you have to wait around for somebody to either invent a new material or take one that's known and bring it up to a level of manufacturing where you could have enough of it to build the tower.
Let me ask both of you, do you think that we need challenges like this today? Are things like this beyond our scope, considering our political climate, our funding climate? Can we get these things, these big ideas done? And do you think science fiction writers, along with engineers like yourself, can move something along here?
Well, ultimately, go ahead, Keith.
Yeah, I think it's, if you thought about, can we do it today in today's climate, I think it'd be pretty hard. You know, we have a Congress that can't even pass a budget. We have conflict all over the world, and so there's some pretty big obstacles to that. But if no one is thinking about such a thing, then the question is 10 years from now, 20 years from now, are you drawn to it? Is there something about it? I think there's still a pretty important issue of making a good business case for it. Is there enough stuff that you can mm-hmm. can do with it? If no one's talking about it, no one's thinking about what you could do with it.
Neil, you wrote a preface. In your preface, you talked about innovation starvation. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I got to say, innovation is no longer on my good list of words, because it tends to get slapped onto everything as a kind of business buzzword. What this anthology very quickly turns into is kind of a discussion of that meta topic you just raised, which is, okay, well, we can imagine all kinds of cool stuff that would be fun to do, but can it really happen politically? And so one of the other stories in the anthology that I thought was quite striking was one by a Canadian science fiction writer named Carl Schrader, who addresses the political side of this head on and talks about ways that technology like the blockchain might be used to kind of get our political process out of its current kind of deadlocked situation.
Mm-hmm. Keith, any comment on that? Getting out of the deadlock, is it just a matter of time, or do we think that other countries with lots of money to spend, like China, or maybe India, is gonna take over the innovation that the U.S. was known for?
Well, I think that's actually possible. You can't sit around forever and not expect the world to kind of lap you. But I think something like this, if you think big enough, it might actually need to be a multinational effort. I mean, the mm-hmm. question of how you would actually get something like this started is pretty difficult to conceive, and those things change over time. And it's really hard to say what might be the trigger that would say, okay, this is something that any nation or any mm-hmm. quadrillionaire, I don't think we have any of those yet, but maybe we'll get some someday.
I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Keith Jelmstead and Neil Stephenson. Neil's author of the anthology Hieroglyph, Stories and Visions for a Better Future. Keith, did science fiction have anything to do with why you became an engineer?
Oh, I think absolutely. When I was young, I was drawn to that kind of stuff. I like to tell people that I first read the Danny Dunn books, but nobody knows what those are.
I know what
anymore,
they are. Magic is paint, his flying machine, his anti-gravity paint, right? I remember those, yeah.
So I was just intrigued with stuff like that, and I read Arthur C. Clarke and things like that. So I don't know if it was I was drawn to it because I was going to become an engineer, or I became an engineer because I was influenced by it.
And Neil, when did sci-fi get so dystopian as it is now?
Well, I'm not a scholar of sci-fi. I'm more of a fan of it and a creator of it. But my own experience is that there was a moment sometime in the 70s or the 80s where we kind of turned away from the sort of Star Trek version of the future, and we started seeing, for example, in Alien, the ship is kind of beat up and dirty, and it's a complicated kind of social environment that these people are operating in, and that gave a feeling of verisimilitude to that movie that was not present in some of the more antiseptic,
right,
versions of the future that we'd seen before, and so. To that point, it's all good. The trend towards cyberpunk literature was also kind of a revelation, and produced some really interesting stuff. I do feel that particularly in movies and television and in video games. They've gotten stuck in a little bit of a creative rut, and so every vision of the future that we seem to see now in movies just kind of consists of taking the present day world and throwing dirt on it and breaking some stuff and having it be kind of miserable.
It's not a vision of the future that's going to inspire anybody.
Yeah, nobody's going to devote their lives to building that future.
All right. I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Keith Jelmstead is professor of structural engineering at Arizona State University in Tempe. Neil Stephenson is a science fiction author and contributor to the new anthology Hieroglyph, Stories and Visions for a Better Future. And you can read the beginning of Neil Stephenson's book about the Tall Tower, Atmosfera Incognita, at our website. That's at sciencefriday.com/hieroglyph. Thank you both for joining us this hour. Good luck.
Thanks, our pleasure.